Hello and welcome to Let's Pod This. Friends, it's good to be with you again this week. I'm recording this on Friday, May 9th. That means that yesterday, May 8th, was a very pivotal deadline in the Oklahoma legislature. Yesterday was basically the deadline for most measures, most bills coming from the opposite chamber to be heard on the floor, right? So it was the day, it was the deadline for Senate bills to be heard on the House floor and for House bills to be heard on the Senate floor. This was essentially the last major deadline date before sine die. So we have a much better picture of what is still alive and mostly what's dead in terms of legislation. Also, because they've been doing a lot of floor work now, that means that a good number of bills have already been sent to the governor's office, and in many cases, he has acted on those, or in some cases, not acted at all and let them take effect without action, right? Like, it's not a pocket veto. I think it's a pocket signature, right? So we'll talk about a couple of those measures, and then we'll do a little bit of a roundup of some other news stories happening around Oklahoma government and politics over the last week. I wanted to highlight three bills this week. One is House Bill 1389. This was a bill authored by Representative Provenzano from Tulsa. It was a bill dealing with breast cancer screenings. And the reason this was particularly interesting is that Representative Provenzano, who is the newly, she was just elected by her colleagues in the Democratic caucus to be the new leader after next year. So, like, this is a little convoluted, but the way it works is it's a 2-year legislature, and so Leader Munson is the leader right now, but they go ahead and elect, kind of planning out a couple of years in advance, which I think is smart. There's a bit of a not a chain of command, but like a legacy planning there. Anyway, Representative Provenzano has been working on this issue for a couple of years, and you've probably seen this in the news, but she's been working on this issue for a couple of years. Never expected that it wasn't about her personally, but a few months ago, she was diagnosed with breast cancer herself. And so this is not just a good policy issue. This is a personal matter. This bill, House Bill 1389, would expand breast cancer screenings. It would include some, like, you know, generally, like, the first typical screening is a mammogram, and then they might say they need an ultrasound or an MRI, and often those are not covered by insurance unless it's, like, specifically ordered. And anyway, in that case, you usually have to fight it. To be totally honest, we've been dealing with this in my house too. My wife, got referred for additional screenings, and that just meant additional headache and hassle and potentially expense. Generally, some of these extra tests can cost $2,000. Now, they're all preventative, right? Their idea is that they are preventative tests so that you can catch cancer earlier and begin treatment earlier. And generally, that's less expensive than if you wait, right? We all know prevention, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. And so it's aimed at that. Well, it passed the House 95-0, right? 100%. No opposition. The entire House voted for it. Super bipartisan, common sense, good legislation. The Senate was also overwhelmingly positive, 34-11 over there. There's about 11 folks over there who will vote no on anything. And so sailed through the legislature. And this is important because this bill just requires insurances to cover this, right? All it does. Because if you don't require insurance companies to cover anything, they won't cover anything. Right? Like, that's how it works. They're in it to make money. Their job is to not pay for shit. And if you don't tell them they have to, they won't. This bill says, hey, you got to pay for this extra screening. The legislature overwhelmingly says, absolutely, we agree. This is super smart, good for everybody. Let's do it. It goes to the governor, and homie Governor Stitt posts a video of his rationale for vetoing this legislation. Now, there's, based on the numbers there, I believe there are enough votes, or really close to it, to override the governor's veto on this. And so I'm hoping that Representative Provenzano can convince leadership that this should be one of the bills that they bring back and attempt to override, because it is just a no-brainer. Anyone who has a woman in their life And we all do, because you all have a mother, a sister, a wife, you know, a aunt, somebody, right? There's an excellent chance that you know somebody who either is dealing with breast cancer right now, who has had breast cancer in the past, who might have died from breast cancer, or who has breasts and need to get these screenings. And guess what, folks? It's not just women, right? My dad, my late father, had a lump in his breast at one point that he had to go in and have some, you know, diagnostic tests for and then get removed. We think about it being a women's issue, and proportionally it is, but it's not only. This is something that is just good common sense for everybody. I think we're all supportive of catching cancer earlier so we can get it treated and help people stay alive. That's what we should all be for. I don't understand. The governor said this is a government mandate, and it's going to mean premiums are going to go up. No, it's not. You know what's going to make premiums go up? A whole bunch of late stage cancer diagnoses that are really expensive to treat, and a whole bunch of, you know, end of life payments they're going to make for people who die from unnecessarily from cancer. That's going to make premiums go up. Asking to pay a little bit for some patients to have a preventative screening, because when this is broadly required, it's going to push prices down as well. So anyway, sad news on that bill. Additionally, sad news on a bill that started over in the Senate, Senate Bill 128. This was authored by Senator Kurt, and her House author was Representative Daniel Pay, a Republican. And this is an issue that she's been working on for a couple of years, dealing with the timeline for evictions in Oklahoma. So you may remember a while back, we had an episode of our podcast with some folks from an organization called ShelterWell. And that podcast, I learned along with you, right, that the timeline for evictions in Oklahoma is very short, crazy short. It's 5 days from the time that they file, when a landlord files something seeking an eviction, all of those have to be heard within 5 days. And this would extend it to, I believe, 10 days. This wasn't that long ago. This was episode, let me scroll. I don't even know what episode this was. 251. So it's about a year ago. We had this. It's the episode title is called Gimme Shelter, with ShelterWell. And it was honestly, even for me, as someone who does this podcast every week, an eye-opening interview. I did not have any real insight into the eviction process in Oklahoma, and it was startling. So anyway, Senator Kurt and Representative Pay aim to extend that timeline by just 5 days, only 5 days, just to make it 10 days. And give, you know, tenants, people who, renters, right, a chance to respond. If something happened, if you were late on your rent and your landlord came in and they waited 5 days or whatever, and then they filed to evict you right away, and you found out that you've got to be in court sometime the next 5 days, well, court's only in the middle of the day. You got to take off work. Well, a lot of folks can't. Like, that's not enough notice to deal with childcare, to deal with requesting off work. A lot of employers require you to give, you know, a couple of weeks notice before you schedule time off. You could theoretically call in sick, but that might be lying. And if they know you're not sick, you could get fired. Like, there's all these other implications that makes it unreasonable. And what happens if you don't show up in court to defend yourself? Well, then the judgment is kind of automatically against you. So this was 10 days is still exceedingly short, but twice as long as what we have right now. That bill also pretty popular, passed the House, passed the Senate first, 26-19, passed the House 51-35, went to the governor's desk, and the governor vetoed it this week as well. Extremely disappointing. Again, this kind of good policy that the governor vetoes for reasons that it just kind of exceed understanding is that's part of what makes this all very frustrating, I think, for all of us. So I don't know if Senator Kurt and Representative Pay are planning to try to whip the votes that would be required for a veto override, they may just aim to refile and try again next year. I don't remember. I watched the debates on these, and I don't remember what the criticism was necessarily, but I think there's a lot of members of the legislature who are landlord themselves, and might, in some cases, might feel like they already do a good job of, like, working with tenants. And you know what? They might. This is generally not the folks that own, you know, one or two or five or even 10, like, rental properties. It is the big corporate landlords who own multiple apartment complexes and who have only see dollars and cents. They don't see people's lives, which is a real shame. Or not even apartment complexes, people who own, you know, there's like big corporations that own tons of homes now that they rent out. This is why we have high rent prices. There's a whole structural problem here that they're trying to come up against. And in many cases, those folks have deep pockets and can pay lobbyists to help defeat bills like this. So I'm hoping that both House Bill 1389 and Senate Bill 128, if they can't override the veto entirely, then maybe they can bring them up again next session and we can have this out and maybe get a little closer to the goal line. Sometimes that's really all it takes. All right, those are only the three bills that I wanted to highlight. There are other bad bills that are out there. I'm still updating my bill tracker after yesterday, and trying to also like go outside this afternoon and enjoy the sunlight, if I'm totally honest. The last couple of weeks of rain and travel for like conferences for me, and then I've just been stuck inside a lot, and I need to go touch grass and, like, you know, maybe drink a beer on a patio, which is what my plans are this afternoon. Before I go, I do want to highlight a few quick news stories. Some of these, if you listen to This Week in Oklahoma Politics over on KOSU, and you should, an excellent radio program, then you may have already heard me discuss these over there. Although I think there's been some new information that's come out, so I will update these. In case you want to know behind the curtain, we typically record This Week in Oklahoma Politics on Wednesday mornings, which is only halfway through the week. So we're always kind of running, you know, a little bit behind the news cycle, which is okay. I will update you here each week when I can. And then undoubtedly, if it's that important, maybe it'll show up again next week, right? Right. The first thing I want to touch on is the situation at ODMHSAS, the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services. Lord almighty, every day is a new news story over there, and I've been concerned for like a month now, and it's just, I'm sure this is how legislators feel too, where you're like, are you kidding me? Something else happened? So last week, the agency told lawmakers that they wouldn't be able to pay employees past this Wednesday, past May 7th. And then when they were pushed, they said, oh, just kidding. We can pay them now, but after May 21st, so in 2 weeks, we can't make that payroll. It's still unclear exactly how much the agency is short for this fiscal year, so which ends at the end of June. So they've just got like 2 months left. They're clearly short some money. They said they can't even make payroll starting in 2 weeks. Okay, well, what does that mean? Like, are you short only payroll? Are you short other expenses? What about all your contracts out to vendors, to other agencies, or to community providers? Like, how much do you really need for the next 2 months? And then what does that mean for next year? These are the questions the legislature is trying to get to the bottom of. You know, going back to January, I think they said, well, we're going to be short $63.7 million. And then a couple of weeks later, they're like, no, just kidding. I think we're only going to be short $43 million. And then a couple of weeks later, Commissioner Ali Friesen said, well, we just need $6.2 million. And then, you know, like Majority Leader Mark Lawson was like, well, how much do you need? Because the legislative liaison called me last week and said that you need $23 million. So we've got four different numbers, 64, 43, 23, and 6. How much how many millions do you actually need? Because you're going to get one shot at this. And if you don't ask for enough, we're not going to give you enough. If you ask for too much, you know, we're not going to do that. Like, let's get the accurate number. It seems like, based on the information at this last meeting, that each payroll period for them, so every 2 weeks, is roughly about $6 million. And so I think before, when she's like, oh, we just need $6 million, she was either, she might have been just like misinformed, like kind of got confused on how much she needed to ask for. And so, you know, if you do the math out, if they were saying they were going to be $64 million short, okay, that's roughly 10 pay periods. That's 5 months of time, and that was in January-ish. And so that might have been pretty close, right? They might have been saying, well, we need more money between now and the end of June. That's going to be about 5 months worth of pay periods. That's probably what they needed. And they tried to talk it down, and maybe they found some money. I don't know how many couch cushions they have at DMH, but I guarantee there's not enough pennies and nickels in there to fill millions of dollars of gap. Speaker Hilbert said that as recently as March 31st, he asked agency leaders if there would be any cash flow issues before the end of May, and he was assured that there would not be. And yet here they are saying, oh, yeah, we can't even make payroll in May. Attorney General Gettner Drummond, who is running for governor, has entered the chat, and he called on Governor Stitt to immediately terminate Commissioner Ali Friesen because of this. You know, if someone's running for office, they're never going to miss a chance to kind of inject themselves into the news cycle. I believe the AG's office is looking into DMH around funding misuse. Maybe they're not yet, but I would bet that might happen, and perhaps would be justified. I know the state auditor, Cindy Byrd, who's also running for lieutenant governor, her office is looking into it and doing a forensic audit, which they definitely need to. The agency has an internal inspector general who's been doing some investigations. However, he resigned last week after more than 21 years with the agency. The agency doesn't have a CFO. They haven't had one for a long time. They had an interim CFO, or chief financial officer. His name was Skip Leonard, but he's been on a contract basis, and his contract expires this week, and Commissioner Friesen made it clear that he would not be continuing in that capacity. Governor Stitt previously said he was going to bring in an independent financial expert to take control of the department's finances, but that hasn't happened yet. He's not named that person. And the thing we haven't even discussed yet about all of this is just like regular monthly bills for the agency just to get through the end of the year. They still have not given the legislature hard numbers for what they actually need. The legislature is working on a budget for next year. They really need those numbers now to make the decision. And none of this even includes the fact that they're closing, or have closed, the state's oldest and largest inpatient mental health facility, which was Griffin Memorial Hospital in Norman. And they have plans to build a new one that was supposed to be open next year, but like they haven't even started, or they've moved some dirt around. And those plans are so far over budget and behind schedule that they're scrapping them entirely, and that's like a sunk cost. So I think they've spent roughly $6 million on that, and they're like, you know what, never mind. We're going to change our plans. We're going to build a different facility. We're just going to buy this building that already exists, but it's smaller and has fewer beds, and it includes way fewer beds for children and adolescents, which was one of the biggest needs. That was one of the selling points for the new facility they were planning. But this one does have more space for people who are incarcerated. And so it's just like, what are we doing? That's what it's like. What are we doing? Man, I mentioned last week that, SCOTUS heard the case about St. Isidore, the virtual charter school, religious church run virtual charter school. I'm not going to rehash that today. We'll wait till June, see what they say. Who knows, right? Who knows? We previously discussed that Governor Stitt has appointed four members since January, I think, four new members to the State Board of Education. One was just last week. Three of them were back in February, but they still have to be confirmed by the Senate, and it looks like one of those will not be confirmed, a guy named Mike Tenney, because he's from Norman. And so his senator, Lisa Standridge, is also this, usually their nomination is carried by whomever their state senator is. But the person that was in that seat before that Stitt ousted and then put this guy in there, that other woman was also like a friend of Senator Standridge. And so Senator Standridge was like, hey, like, I don't really like that you ousted my friend. I know this guy's my friend too, but you're putting me in a tough spot, and I don't feel comfortable carrying the nomination. The pro tem could do it, but he's kind of talked around, and Senator Pugh from Edmond got involved, and they really had some conversations, and it sounds like there's not a willingness to carry this guy's nomination, which means it goes back to the governor for him to appoint a fifth person now. Only four spots, but another person. And that person would also have to be confirmed by the governor. Now, I think it was last year, the governor called the legislature back in to a special session simply to deal with the issue of his appointments that have not yet been confirmed, right? So he's appointed so many people that they haven't confirmed, including, I think, a bunch of his cabinet secretaries. They need to get to work on that. So we'll see what happens. Time is running out. I would not at all be surprised to see a special session this year again for that very purpose. And then another story that is a bit more of a heartstrings story. Many of you are undoubtedly familiar with the Heartland Flyer, which is the train, the Amtrak train that goes between Oklahoma City and Fort Worth, Texas. It's been around for decades, right? I know I haven't actually been on it myself. It's perpetually on my to-do list of things we want to do. We just got to make time to do it, and I think our daughter would enjoy it, or all three of our kids for that matter, but I think specifically my youngest would be into it. I mean, trains are kind of nostalgic anyway. They're underused in America. We could have all my friends on the coast, especially the East Coast, where they can like take a train up and down the East Coast from DC to Maine. I'll have Zoom calls with them. They're like, oh, I'm on the train. Like, and it's good Wi-Fi. We have a good conversation. And I'm just like, this here in the middle of America, we are left out on this. We're just stuck in our cars. Anyway, Heartland Flyer is supported by, I think, some federal money and some ticket revenue, like when you buy tickets, and then also state money from both Oklahoma and Texas. And the Texas legislature had said, we're not going to fund this. It's only a few million dollars, like $3 or $4 million, but it's money that's necessary, right? So in the scheme of the Texas budget, it's pretty small, but it still has to be funded. Texas A&M University, their transportation institute, said that the train brings in more than $18 million in economic impact to Texas. So clearly it's paying for itself. Like, they're putting in $3 or $4 million and getting $18 million back. That's a good deal. And the other thing that's important to Oklahoma is that if the train keeps going, it was announced last year that they're planning to re-expand the route north of Oklahoma City, going through Guthrie, Perry, Ponca City, all the way up to Newton, Kansas, which is just north of Wichita. So it'll go through Wichita, go to Newton. There's kind of a hub there that connects trains from, you know, Dallas to Oklahoma City, to Wichita, to Kansas City, to Chicago, to Los Angeles. Like, this is like a intercontinental hub. It's a big deal. It'd be really rad to be able to ride a train all the way to Chicago. That would be awesome. You could go see where the Pope's from, right? Hey, we got a new Pope, folks. The memes this week have been outstanding. I shared a whole bunch of them on Instagram the other night. Really good memification of this Pope and American Pope announcement. I honestly couldn't care either way, but I do appreciate the jokes. I love the Chicago dog. I love the Cubs. I have a soft spot for Chicago for all kinds of reasons. Anyway, congrats to Pope Leo the 4th, 6th? I forget what those, 9th? There's a lot of letters there in the Roman numerals. Anyway, you can ride the train. That's what I'm trying to say, from Oklahoma City all the way to Chicago. And how cool would that be? Really get to see middle of America. And then you could just like scroll Instagram the whole way and not worry about crashing your car and killing people. Hey, isn't that great? That would be a big deal. The route would also, in Oklahoma, expanding it through Oklahoma would create an estimated $65 million in annual economic impact. The mayor, Wagner, in Ponca City told me a few weeks ago that they've already committed $3 million for their town, which is a ton of money for Ponca City, to restore its historic train depot in anticipation of this expansion. So that's a really big deal. I'm hoping that plays out. I forgot an update. Sorry. I know I'm jumping around a bit, but to go back to that to that Department of Mental Health story, the other thing that came out just yesterday, I think, is that maybe it was on Wednesday, all these community behavioral health centers have told the media, like, they're like, hey, I know they're worried about their money, but they also haven't paid us on the order of $150 million that the Department of Mental Health has not reimbursed community providers for. Because so the way it works is that community mental health providers bill Medicaid or other insurance if it's available, but there's a lot of folks that don't have insurance, right? That are, you know, considered uninsured, and that the department historically like pays the agencies, the organizations, to provide care to those people as well. And it's, they have to kind of bill. It's not just like a block grant. It's like, we'll bill us and we'll pay you for it. And they haven't done that. They usually don't even pay all of it. So they kind of know that they're not going to pay all of it, but usually they're like, hey, listen, we can pay all but $600,000 or something. But now they're like, we can pay none of it, which is like tens of millions of dollars. And so if this doesn't get fixed in a big way, not only is it bad for the Department of Mental Health itself, it is really bad for, you know, all these community organizations. In Oklahoma City, you've got groups like North Care and Hope Community Services and Red Rock and tons of others, right? Tulsa, Youth and Family Services. There's a bunch of others I'm blanking on, but I guarantee that you are familiar with these organizations who provide services to thousands of Oklahomans. And if all of a sudden they all went belly up and all these folks can't get medications, can't get therapy, can't get the support they need, it's going to have like huge ripples through the state in not good ways. And so they really, gosh, this is an all hands on deck situation with the Department of Mental Health. All right, well, from trains to mental health, we've really covered the gamut today. Friends, thanks for being here. This will be a shorter episode because it's late in session and it's sunny on Friday and I am out of energy. I'm going to go meet two of my buddies so we can rant together about the state of the world at Skydance Brewing here on the patio. I'm going to publish this. If you happen to get this in your feed in the next 2 hours, come join us. Otherwise, we'll see you back here next week, and I'll be doing a podcast remotely from the American Democracy Summit in sunny and hot Phoenix, Arizona. I'm looking forward to it. I'll share updates from there as well as what's happening in Oklahoma politics and government with you again next week. Friends, don't forget, decisions are made by those who show up. However you can, find a way to show up for your friends and neighbors today. Have a good week.